Hello and welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the show, as always, is dedicated to writers, books, and publishing. And my guest today for the entire hour is Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Wild, the New York Times bestseller, Tiny Beautiful Things, and the novel, Torch. Wild was chosen by Oprah Winfrey as her first selection for Oprah's Book Club 2.0. It's been optioned for film by Reese Witherspoon's production company, Pacific Standard. IndieBound selected Wild as their number one indie next pick for April. Barnes & Noble named it a Discover Great New Writers pick on their summer 2012 list, and Amazon named it a Best of March pick. So much more about Cheryl. I'm sure we're going to talk about her resume. Her credits go on, and I'm just delighted to have her here. If you want to read more about her and what's going on with her as the show goes on or afterward, visit her website, CherylStrayed.com. In the meantime, let's bring her on to talk about Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. You know, I've just read Wild and I'm reading Tiny Beautiful Things, and the voice of both of these books, but particularly Tiny Beautiful Things, which is basically a series of advice letters that were in Rumpus.com, your advice column. You're so generous. Your voice, your spirit is so generous. And I was thinking back to when we met at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, and there was sort of a similar kind of sincerity that came through just in talking with you for a little bit there. So anyway, I just want to thank you. I think it's wonderful to have you on the show and to have you writing and publishing and Tiny Beautiful Things. Let's just talk for that, and we're probably going to bounce back and forth between the two books.
Okay.
But talk about Tiny Beautiful Things and how that came about.
Tiny Beautiful Things. And first, I just want to say thank you so much for those kind words. It is kind of interesting to me that, you know, that sincerity. I've always written with sincerity, and that hasn't always been the cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Often I think that's been seen as you know, you can't be, it's hard to be cool and sincere at the same time, because so often we associate coolness with kind of indifference.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really has been sort of surprising to me that the Dear Sugar column was greeted so warmly when I was being so earnest in it. I think it tells us something about our culture and what we're really ready for.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, so Tiny Beautiful Things was really the book I wrote by accident. It's interconnected with Wild. I had finished Wild, the first polished draft of Wild, in February of 2010, and sent it off to my editor, who by then, at Knopf, had by then bought the book. And so I sent it to her, and I was in that wonderful moment where I'm just waiting for, you know, to get her notes back. To see what she has to say in terms of, you know, my editor's, you know, suggestions for revision. And it was in that little lull where I felt like I'd just done this really big thing and finished this book that I received an email from my friend Steve Almond.
Mm-hmm.
And probably you know his work, and many of your
mm-hmm.
listeners know his work. He's a great writer and a wonderful man. And he said, "I have been writing this advice column anonymously for a website called therumpus.net. And it's called Dear Sugar. It hasn't gained much, you know, he didn't really feel deeply invested in the column. He didn't feel like he was that interested in it. And he said, look, it doesn't pay anything. There's no real reason for you to say yes to this. But of course, I said yes. And I said yes really for the same reason that I said yes to my hike on the PCT, which I wrote about in Wild. And that is just something inside me just said that something sparked, you know, something seemed to be interesting. And so I decided that I would try to do this thing that I'd never done before, and that is write an advice column.
Interesting. You know, it just sounds like you jump into, I don't know, jump into your fears and see what's there and kind of live through that in a way. I mean, through Wild, it's like, oh my gosh, 1,100 miles a hike alone for the most part?
Yeah.
You had never backpacked.
Right. I'd hiked a lot before, but I'd never gone backpacking, which it turns out they're two different things. You know? Day hiking, you know, you wake up in your bed and you go and have brunch, you know, tank up for the big hike, and then you're out there, but then by the day's end, you're back in your comfort zone. You're back, you know, in the world of nice foods and wine and comfy beds and hot showers and such. And backpacking, you're not. You know, it's not like a bunch of day hikes stuck together. It's a whole different thing. And I had never, you know, I'd grown up in the North Woods of Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota, and I'd lived in my teen years in a very rustic way without electricity or running water or indoor plumbing for most of those years. And so, you know, the wilderness was definitely a home place for me. And, you know, all these years later, we're talking about a hike I took the summer of 1995 when I was 26. And, you know, so there were things that I could understand about myself, you know, while I was writing Wild years later, looking back. And one of the things is I really figured out, you know, I'd really turned to this trip as a way to sort of save myself at this bottom moment of my life. My mom had died very suddenly of cancer at the age of 45 a few years before I decided to take this hike. I was a senior in college. And really my life in my grief sort of unwound. And I became really self-destructive and just had moved into a dark place and was really trying to find myself. And my decision to hike the PCT was my way of trying to do that in a healthy way rather than a destructive way like I'd been doing. And so, you know, in retrospect, I can see that I think I did turn to the wilderness because after my mom died, I'd really lost that home where I'd grown up. My family disintegrated, and the man she was married to, my stepfather, wasn't really a father to me so much anymore. And so I really think I was turning to that by hiking the PCT.
And then it at some point became a book. Mm-hmm. Now, did it begin with an essay, or did it go straight to book?
What happened is, so I took the hike. I was a writer when I went on the hike, an aspiring writer more than a writer, but I was writing all the time, and that was absolutely my dream and my passion. And those of you, your listeners who have read Wild, know that sometimes I talk about, you know, that I was sort of writing a novel in my head as I hiked, and, mm-hmm. and indeed that novel got written. You know, it was my first book called Torch that was published by Houghton Mifflin in 2006, mm-hmm. and actually a couple days it's going to be reissued, a new edition by Vintage Books with a new preface by me. But I went on that hike not thinking I was going to write a book about it. I was going on that hike, honestly, to save myself, not to sound too dramatic, but I think that's really how it was, you know. And I did it. You know, that hike set me on a new course in my life. It allowed me to turn back to that passion and focus on my writing. And so what happened is I wrote Torch and sold it when I was pregnant with my first child. By the time it was published a couple years later, I had two kids under the age of two, and I spent several months promoting it and traveling around the country with them in tow. I'd always imagined a sort of entourage on my book tour, and mm-hmm. yeah, I didn't have in mind a newborn and a toddler, but anyway, they were my entourage, and then I just thought, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to do another book in any kind of reasonable amount of time? I was really worried about how I would balance, you know, mothering two little kids and writing that next book. And I I by then published several essays, and I thought maybe what I could do is just to throw together a collection of essays, and that will be this kind of book I can get out really quickly, and it can be sort of the book I have out while I'm, you know, writing this real next book. And, you know, because most of those essays had already been written and published, and I thought, well, I'll write a few that are original essays to the book. And, you know, this one part of my life that I hadn't written about yet was my hike on the PCT. And so I started to write what I thought was going to be an essay about my hike. I thought that I had only about 20 or 30 pages worth of something to say about that hike. And so that's how Wild was born, is I began writing what I thought was an essay, and instead I realized that it was a book, that it was really, that I had so much, you know.
Really interesting. Really interesting stuff. This is, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Cheryl Strayed. We're talking about Wild. We're talking about Tiny Beautiful Things. And we're talking about Torch, which is going to be reissued. And I must read that one, too. And, you know, I'm curious because I wasn't aware, I should have been, but I wasn't aware that Torch was a novel. And because I was going to ask you what, you know, how you became interested in the memoir form or nonfiction, and you're writing both, and I'd love to hear you talk about that and talk about what leads you into both. What, and if it's still that way, I mean, can you see yourself going back to fiction? Does it just depend on the idea?
Yeah, I think I'll always write both, but it never occurred to me to be a nonfiction writer early on. I was always a fiction writer. And my first essays were actually born out of Torch. So Torch is a novel. A lot of people read it and assume it's more nonfiction than it is, and that is because, you know, like many first novels, it does have some strong autobiographical elements in the novel. As the novel opens, we learn that the young mother, Teresa Wood, is going to die of cancer very soon, and she does. And she dies in a way that's very similar to the way my mom actually died. And the family lives in a place in northern Minnesota that's very similar to the place I really did live. And so those are the two big sort of autobiographical points to the book. I mean, and certainly they are what drove me to tell that particular story. I felt this burning in my, you know, just really this burning sense in my gut, really, that I had to tell this story about this family's grief. But beyond that, you know, these are characters I created, these storylines, you know, the things that happen to those characters aren't things that happen to me and my family members. Some things like those things happened, but, you know, I really did take my life, like a lot of novelists do, and, you know, set it to sea, I guess, in the sort of sea of fiction. And I only then, when I was in the midst of writing that book, that I woke up one day. I actually can tell you the very day. It was the 4th of July in 1997, and I was at the Wurlitzer Foundation in Taos. It's a writer's colony, and I was there as a writer in residence, and I was getting really deep into the first work I was doing on Torch. And I woke up that morning, and I just felt horrified that I had really started to forget my actual mother, because I was becoming so invested in this character of Teresa Wood, who was a lot like my mom, but wasn't my mom, that I was sort of forgetting who was my mom and who was this fictional character.
Mm.
They were becoming one person. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a loss to me. It felt like I was losing another piece of my mother. And, you know, my mom's been dead now. It'll be, you know, 22 years in March. And so, you know, I'm constantly losing another piece of her and then gaining another piece back in different ways. But at the time, it felt sad to me. And so what I decided to do on the 4th of July is just to write just the true story of her death. And it wasn't going to be anything that I was going to publish. It was just going to be me just writing the true story of her death. And so I sat down and started to do that. And what happened is, as I told the story of her death, I started to also tell the story of my experience getting involved with a man who was a heroin addict a few years after my mom died, and my own experience using heroin and essentially dabbling with, you know, coming very close to becoming addicted to heroin. And so in one day, one like 12-hour binge writing day, I wrote this essay that's called Heroin. And it ended up being, you know, it was the first essay I ever wrote, and I sent it off to a magazine that doesn't exist anymore. It's called Double Take Magazine. It was
magazine. I love that magazine.
Me too. And they published it, and then it was chosen for Best American Essays.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a real, you know, my first experience suddenly, you know, because it suddenly had this big audience, you know, it was read by so many people in Best American Essays, I think I was regarded as an essayist. And so by the time, you know, it took years to write and publish Torch, some reviewers would say, you know, the essayist Cheryl Strayed has now turned her attention to the novel. And I would always laugh because I was like, no, I was always focused on the novel. And these essays just sort of popped up around the edges as I was writing Torch. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with, you know, then I started to really enjoy writing essays, and I started to think, and I love the power of that nonfiction voice. I love the feeling of that author looking right at you and saying, you know, this really happened to me. I'm telling you a story about my life. I don't think it's any more true in that big capital T sense than fiction can be. I mean, some of the most devastating truths are in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that big truth can be delivered through both fiction and nonfiction equally. I just think you work a slightly different, it's the same muscle, but a different toolbox, the way I consider it. Like, when I'm writing fiction, it feels the same way to me as writing nonfiction, but I just am bound in one to what actually happened, and in the other, I can make things happen. I mean, you know, it's all about what you imagine could happen. So I think that the next thing I want to write, a novel next. That's what's really interesting to me right now.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that. I like that you go back and forth and that you don't feel limited to one. And it is interesting how reviewers or the media have this need to categorize authors. Or, like you said, you published an essay, so now you're an essayist.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people. Well, and what's really funny about that is, you know, it's a rare writer who only works in one genre, you know. I mean, most writers end up writing essays at some point. I mean, most poets, you know, you write a poem and, you know, then you write an essay about the poem. You know, I mean, I think that there are, we're all really moving, you know, into different, and, you know, and then with this advice column thing, I mean, that was another, you mentioned earlier about, did I seem to sort of throw myself into the direction of fear, and I think that there's something about that, you know, that I do feel like, if whatever the next thing is doesn't take me outside the comfort zone, I'm probably not doing the right thing, you know? And when I took over when I wrote Torch, I was just panicked the whole time because I thought, I don't know how to write a book. And what I realized is the grand agony of writing your first book is the only way to learn how to write a book is to write a book, you know? The book teaches you how to write a book.
Yes.
And it's a really scary thing. It's like having your first baby. I felt the exact same way when I was pregnant. I didn't know anything about babies. And I realized once my son was born that that he was going to teach me how to be a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And Torch taught me how to write a book, how to be an author.
Mm.
And then with Wild, I knew how to write a book, and I relied a lot on what I'd learned with Torch. You know, all of those times that I felt like, my goodness, this is never, you know, I'll never finish this, and it's completely a mess, and the whole thing is a way, you know, all of those self-loathing things I think most writers feel. I would just think back to feeling that way when I was writing Torch, and I would know, just keep going forward and keep swimming across that sea. You will reach the shore someday, and, you know, but the challenge with Wild was, well, how do I write a memoir? You know, how do I mine actual experience in a way that's actually meaningful and isn't just recounting, you know, what happened. And then with Tiny Beautiful Things, it was, how do I give advice? You know, and how do I transcend the form? Because the advice column is not inherently a literary form. You know, in fact, it's not a literary form. It's a form that somebody in a couple of paragraphs who usually positions him or herself in a place of superiority tells someone what to do. And I knew I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it a literary form. So I had to sort of just, you know, try that with a lot of fear and doubt.
I'd love to hear you read from Tiny Beautiful Things. Would you do that?
Yeah. You know, I thought I'd read a column. The last, you know, most of my columns are quite long, and so, you know, too long for our purposes today, but I thought I'd just read the last bit of a column called The Ghost Ship That Didn't Carry Us. And the situation is, there's a man who's written to me who is about 40, and he and his longtime girlfriend, who's also about 40, are trying to figure out whether they should have a child. they are perfectly happy being childless, and yet they both have this kind of nagging feeling of wondering, you know, what would they be missing if they decide never to have children? And I think a lot of people really struggle with this very question, and other things like it. And so in my advice, I am encouraging him to really imagine, you know, both scenarios. And I guess I'll just read you the final, the last maybe couple pages of it. Okay?
Yep.
What don't you know? Make a list. Write down everything you don't know about your future life, which is everything, of course, but use your imagination. What are the thoughts and images that come to mind when you picture yourself at twice the age you are now? What springs forth if you imagine the 82-year-old self who opted to keep enjoying the same life? And what when you picture the 82-year-old self with a 39-year-old son or daughter? Write down same life and son or daughter. And underneath each, make another list of the things you think those experiences would give to and take away from you, and then ponder which entries on your list might cancel each other out. Would the temporary loss of a considerable portion of your personal freedom in middle age be significantly neutralized by the experience of loving someone more powerfully than you ever have? Would the achy uncertainty of never having been anyone's father be diffused by the glorious reality that you got to live your life relatively unconstrained by the needs of another? What is a good life? Write good life and list everything that you associate with a good life, then rank them in order of importance. Have the most meaningful things in your life come to you as a result of ease or struggle? What scares you about sacrifice? What scares you about not sacrificing? So there your gigantic white piece of paper with things written all over it like a ship's sail. And maybe you don't have clarity still. Maybe you don't know what to do. But you feel something, don't you? The sketches of your real life and your sister life are right there before you, and you get to decide what to do. One is the life you'll have. The other is the one you won't. Switch them around in your head and see how it feels. Which affects you on a visceral level? Which won't let you go? Which is ruled by fear? Which is ruled by desire? Which makes you want to close your eyes and jump? And which makes you want to turn and run? In spite of my own fears, I didn't regret having a baby. My son's body against mine was the clarity I never had. The first few weeks of his life, I felt honestly rattled by the knowledge of how close I'd come to opting to live my life without him. It was a penetrating, relentless, unalterable thing to be his mother, my life ending and beginning at once. If I could go back in time, I'd make the same choice in a snap. And yet there remains my sister life, all the other things I could have done instead. I won't know what I couldn't know until I became a mom, and so I am certain there are things I don't know because I can't know because I did. Who would I have nurtured had I not been nurturing my two children over these past 7 years? In what creative and practical forces would my love have been gathered up? What didn't I write? Because I was catching my children at the bottoms of slides and spotting them as they balanced along the tops of low brick walls and pushing them endlessly in swings? What did I write? Because I did. Would I be happier and more intelligent and prettier if I'd been free all this time to read in silence on a couch that sat opposite of Mr. Sugar's? Would I complain less? Has sleep deprivation and the consumption of an exorbitant number of Annie's homegrown organic cheddar bunnies taken years off of my life, or added years onto it? Who would I have met if I'd bicycled across Iceland and hiked around Mongolia? And what would have I experienced, and where would that have taken me? I'll never know, and neither will you of the life you don't choose. We'll only know that whatever that sister life was, it was important and beautiful, and not ours. It was the ghost ship that didn't carry us. There's nothing to do but salute it from the shore. Sugar.
Lovely. Really just gorgeous. We're going to take a short break. That was Cheryl Strayed reading from Tiny Beautiful Things. We'll be right back with more Cheryl Strayed, so stay with us. ¶¶
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello there, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Cheryl Strayed. We're going to bring her right back on. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, that, you know, what you read, and I mean, so many of these letters and your responses, your responses mostly are so moving. The last one is just enough to undo you, and so everybody, you have to check out this book, because, oh my gosh, I was wondering as I'm reading this, reading your responses, because they're so emotional and wild, too. You know, you're so revealing, and did it ever worry you? Did you ever feel like you're saying too much, you're revealing yourself too much, or are you just naturally open, and so you just go, you know what, this is just me, and I'm just going to just be me?
It is. It's a little bit of both, but it's mostly the latter. You know, a lot of people ask me about this. You know, they say that I'm candid or fearless or all of those things, and I always, they say, well, how did you get to, you know, why do you do that? And I can never think of the answer, because I think really what it is that's how I am, and it's how I write. And it's also what, to me, is the whole deal with writing. I mean, that's what's interesting to me about writing. I mean, what differentiates writers from the rest of the world is, you know, I really do take very seriously our obligation to be truth-tellers. You know, we tell stories. We make images with words. We find meaning in experience. And we you know, our job is to really dig into that and reveal. And so I think that, I try to do that at every turn. I think a lot of people get that confused with it. To me, it's not about confession. You know, we've all had terrible things happen to us. We all have deep sorrows and tragedies and weird experiences and funny experiences. And we all have that whole range of life, right? And the writer's job is to try to not just report what happened and, reveal every dark corner, but rather tap into what do these things mean to us as individual humans and therefore as universal humans. You know, in every personal story I've ever told, what I wanted to do was not reveal myself, but to reveal the human condition. And one thing that's really been so interesting to me about really all three of my books, but maybe especially this has happened a lot with Wild, is people will write to me, and maybe because Wild is the book that's been most widely read, is that people send me these long emails, and the first sentence or two will say that they like the book, or you know some reaction to the book itself, and then the rest of the email is the story, their story, and paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of how it was that they deeply relate to the story I told in Wild.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people really recognize themselves, and I think that that's what we do when writers really tell the truth about what it means to be human, and whether that human be the author, him or herself, or a character the author has created, people recognize the human experience. And even if it's not something that they, like a lot of people say, well, I've never gone hiking before, but, and they have some corollary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, with Tiny Beautiful Things, many people, when they see that, oh, this is a collection of advice columns, they think that they're not going to be interested in reading this book,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because they think, well, I'm not into advice columns, or I don't need advice, or the letter will be, from someone who doesn't share their problem, essentially. But I always try to answer the questions in a very universal way, that I might be talking to someone specifically about infidelity, but what I'm also really talking about is the complexities of love, And so I think that's what I strive to do is to really go as deep as I can, and get as honest as I can, by way of telling the truth.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah, and you do that. I mean, you do that in Tiny Beautiful Things, and you do that in Wild. And Wild is revealing in a whole other way. It's mm-hmm. it's really interesting. What about writing about siblings and people you know? I mean, like in Wild, did you have any reservations, or did you let anybody vet your manuscript, or did lawyers just address various things at the publishing company and you had to make sure, or how did that go?
Well, writing about other people is the worst part of mm-hmm. writing a memoir or a personal essay. It's really miserable because you don't want to hurt people's feelings, and you also, I think, you have to be very careful about, their right to privacy. I didn't feel that I had the right to, really expose my siblings or invade their privacy, or my stepfather, or, any number of the people I wrote about, and so I had to strike a really fine balance. I didn't give it to them for them to vet it first, but I was really careful about the stories I told about them, that there are much bigger stories about my siblings and my stepfather and my biological father that they weren't necessary for the story I was telling. My story was, Wild is about me, and of course I'm going to write about the people in my life, and to some extent had to reveal some things about them, but I also at every turn, really tried to protect them from being unnecessarily dragged into being exposed. And that, nobody's been, I gave the book to my brother right before it came out, and he read it and just really loved it and was moved by it. And we had really the most profound conversation of our life, because of this book. It brought to the surface, I think, things that he had buried. In fact, that's what he told me. And so that was really a great experience. I haven't had a negative experience in writing about other people, but it is something I take very seriously. I'm not candid about others in the same way I'm candid about myself. Let's just say that,
mm-hmm.
Because they're not the person writing the story, and I don't have a right to do that. So it was also vetted by the Knopf legal team, and it was really interesting because they really had no, they didn't have any problems with it. They did ask me, there's this little, maybe 4 or 5 page passage about my biological father who was not a good father, and I do have to say some things about him that, are unpleasant and critical. But the attorney at the publishing house, she said, would your siblings, say basically the same thing about your father, can they essentially back you up? And I said, yes. And she said, okay, you don't have to change anything. The truth is an absolute defense, she said, which I thought was really pretty great.
That is interesting, yeah. The truth is the absolute defense.
Yeah.
Because I know, you know, a lot of, especially beginning writers, but even, you know, seasoned writers who are writing their first memoir consider what they might have to go through in writing their truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much do I tell? How much do I hold back? Yeah.
It's a question that I'm always asking myself. And the advice I give to my students when I teach, and I would give to any of your listeners who are undertaking such an endeavor, is, you know, I think sometimes we sit down at our computers and there's this feeling that, like, whatever we write is going to be immediately sucked through some sort of portal tube and then published in The New Yorker, you know? And we wish it would be, right? But that's not the case. And I think it's really important to write what you need to write first, right? Write the whole story first. Because when you first start writing something, you don't even really know what the story is. You know, you have to find the story through writing. And then what I found is with every draft of Wild, for example, when I was doing revisions, I would be able to see, like, do you need to know? You know, there might be a sentence about my brother that tells you two things about him. And I can see that I really only need that one thing about him. And if I cross out this other thing about him, that's one layer. Like, I'm not revealing something about him that would be a negative thing that the readers of Wild didn't really need to know, you know? And so at every turn, I was scaling back what I was saying about others and expanding what I was saying about myself. And that became really part of the revision process because I could see more clearly what that story was about. And it wasn't about whatever troubles my siblings have had, for example, since our mom died. It was about my journey. So I was able to just say, that's not necessary, even though in my life it has been part of the story, you know.
So how does the book differ from, say, an early draft, even a first draft of the book?
The first draft is about 25,000 words longer than the published book. And I always sort of say it's like the technically, you know, in terms of just like all the different things that happened on the PCT and all the things that happened in my life, it's like the truest version in terms of it. It contains the most information. So like everyone I met on the trail, you know, that I remembered meeting, I, you know, wrote in that first draft because I was trying to figure out like who did I need to include in the book, who do I exclude, and that's always the problem with memoir is, you know, like here you've got this whole life and, you know, you can't put everything into the book, but you need to put in, you know, you need to put in what's necessary. And so it wasn't until I had it all down that I could see where to scale back.
Interesting. Yeah. And was that a long process? I mean, did you get the draft down and have readers and help, you know, who helped you kind of figure out what belonged and what didn't belong, or did just letting it chill for a while allow you to see it more clearly, see what you needed and what you didn't need?
It was really, so I wrote the book, you know, pretty quickly. Once I started really going into it, I wrote that first draft pretty quickly. And I do have a writer's group, but we bring in just like 7 pages at a time. So they didn't, before I sent that draft off to my editor, the only person who had read like the whole book, you know, and given me feedback, my agent and my husband, and then my writer's group did read the whole book, but it was like they read the same version that my editor did. So I wanted to get their notes and then also hear, you know, what my editor had to say, and so it was a sort of combination of you know, hearing what they had to say and then very much you know, listening to my editor Robin Desser, who, you know, sent me a long letter, and we had many long conversations. And so then in that second draft, you know, everyone agreed, which I knew would be true. You know, okay, it's too long. What can we, you know, what scenes kind of repeat themselves? What don't we need? You know, where do we need to see this more clearly, and where are you going on too long about something? So it was really this listening to that kind of feedback and then going off into my own little metaphorical cave and just going right back into the story. And you know, some things stayed exactly the same and other things were entirely, you know, reworked or trimmed. You know, I remember one day I had this glorious experience where I took there were 14 pages in that first draft, and in the course of revising them, I got them down to something like two or three sentences. And, you know, it felt like it was that one of those wonderful moments you have as a writer where you think, oh, because there was nothing inherently wrong with those 14 pages. They were fine, you know, but they weren't necessary. And I think that that is one of the things you really have to figure out as a writer. You know, even if those 14 pages are entertaining and well-written and great, you know, they've got all kinds of great things going for them, if they're not necessary, they're not necessary. And so if you can say in three sentences what needs to be said and needs to be communicated instead of those 14 pages, you often should do that. And so when I did that, like, my heart just sort of, first it sunk, like, bye-bye, you know. But then I thought, wow, I just did real work there. That was some heavy lifting to really figure that out. And that's a process. That's not something you can do in draft one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it takes... So what happened, so with Wild, I did two full, like, full revisions where I went back into the whole book and you know, really looked at it deeply. And then one kind of like, you know, now that I think of it, I should add this here or take that out there or move that here. You know, I mean, one that was more of a tweak. You know, and those were sort of, over the course of several months, I would think, you know, I'm going to change that sentence. You know, so I had some time, too, because my pub date, even my book was done like more than a year before it was published. It was just sort of waiting in the publishing pipeline, and because they felt it was best to bring it out in the spring instead of the summer, fall, or winter.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it could have been published in the summer of 2011, they wanted to wait till the spring of 2012. And so at first I thought that was terrible because I was just waiting and waiting. But then I realized, you know, it gave me time to sort of reflect upon the book and make last-minute changes, you know, just tiny things that no one but me would notice. And so I got to do that.
Hmm. Interesting. Will you read for a few minutes
Sure.
from the book? That'd be great. So if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but we have a few minutes left with Cheryl Strayed, and she's going to read from Wild.
So I had never gone backpacking, as we talked before, but I decided I was going to do this anyway, and I was living in Minneapolis at the time, working as a waitress and a writer, but every week I would go to REI, which is this outdoor store where I bought, you know, all my things for my backpacking trip, and they're really good at selling you things, you know. So I bought all this gear and went, loaded it all up, and got myself to the town of Mojave, California,
mm-hmm.
and which is near the trail. And I checked into a motel. And what I'm going to read is the morning where I'm packing my pack for the first time. I've got all this stuff piled on the bed in this motel room.
Okay.
Finally, when everything I was going to carry was in the place that I needed to carry it, a hush came over me. I was ready to begin. I looked at my pack. It was at once enormous and compact, mildly adorable and intimidatingly self-contained. It had an animate quality. In its company, I didn't feel entirely alone. Standing, it came up to my waist. I gripped it and bent to lift it. It wouldn't budge. I squatted and grasped its frame more robustly and tried to lift it again. Again, it didn't move, not even an inch. I tried to lift it with both hands, with my legs braced beneath me, while attempting to wrap it in a bear hug, with all of my breath and might and will, with everything in me, and still it would not come. It was exactly like attempting to lift a Volkswagen Beetle. It looked so cute, so ready to be lifted, and yet it was impossible to do. I sat down on the floor beside it and pondered my situation. How could I carry a backpack more than 1,000 miles over rugged mountains and rot waterless deserts if I couldn't even budge it an inch in an air-conditioned motel room? The notion was preposterous, and yet I had to lift that pack. It hadn't occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to. I'd simply thought that if I added up all the things I needed in order to go backpacking, it would equal a weight that I could carry. The people at REI, it was true, had mentioned weight rather often in their soliloquies, but I hadn't paid much attention. I thought about what I might take out of my pack, but each item struck me as either so obviously needed or so in case of emergency necessary that I didn't dare remove it. I would have to try to carry the pack as it was. I scooted over the carpet and situated myself on my rump right in front of my pack, wove my arms through the shoulder straps and clipped the sternum strap across my chest. I took a deep breath and began rocking back and forth to gain momentum until finally I hurled myself forward with everything in me and got myself onto my hands and knees. My backpack was no longer on the floor. It was officially attached to me. It still seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle, only now it seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle that was parked on my back. I stayed there for a few moments trying to get my balance. Slowly I worked my feet beneath me while simultaneously scaling the metal cooling unit attached to the wall with my hands until I was vertical enough that I could do a deadlift. The frame of the pack squeaked as I rose, it too straining from the tremendous weight. By the time I was standing, which is to say hunching in a remotely upright position, I was holding the vented metal panel that I'd accidentally ripped loose from the cooling unit in my efforts. I couldn't even begin to reattach it. The place it needed to go was only inches out of my reach, but those inches were entirely out of the question. I propped the panel against the wall, buckled my hip belt, and staggered and swayed around the room. My center of gravity pulled in any direction I so much as leaned. The weight dug painfully into the tops of my shoulders, so I cinched my hip belt tighter and tighter still, trying to balance the burden, squeezing my middle so tightly that my flesh ballooned out on either side. My pack rose up like a mantle behind me, towering several inches above my head and gripped me like a vice all the way down to my tailbone. It felt pretty awful, and yet perhaps this is how it felt to be a backpacker. I didn't know. I only knew that it was time to go. So I opened the door and stepped into the light.
Love it. Thank you. That was Cheryl Strayed reading from Wild. And, you know, I don't know if anybody else has said this. Probably someone has. But as I was reading, I was reminded of John Krakauer's Into Thin Air.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people say Into the Wild because they think of my journey in some ways like Chris McCandless's, who, you know, went off to Alaska. But that's interesting. Yeah, some...
Just sort of that sort of adventure kind of, you know, drama, true story sort of, you know, that you'd like to do it, you can't imagine doing it, and here's this person who did it.
and what more is, here's this person who, if I can do it, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really do feel that way. You know, sometimes I think we get this idea that there are certain activities, and surely climbing Mount Everest, you do have to be prepared in ways, and I don't mean to advocate that you just, you know, stagger into the wilderness and be unprepared. And you know, I was essentially prepared. I just, you know, I took too much stuff like a lot of backpackers, and I made some mistakes, but I also learned out there. And like I said, a book teaches you how to write a book. Writing a book teaches you how to write a book, and having a baby teaches you how to be a parent. And, you know, walking through the wilderness teaches you how to walk through the wilderness. And I think that sometimes we go too far in this preparedness and this idea that, you know, that only the people who you know, have are like experts in the field or something can do that. And, you know, I think that I did have a lot to learn, and I learned it when I went out there. And, you know, the reason I read that passage about this thing, this pack I had that I couldn't lift, is I really do think that that's what Wild is about, and I think it's what Tiny Beautiful Things is about too. It's about having, you know, learning how to bear the weight that we feel we cannot bear. Bearing the unbearable is something that we have to do over and over again in our lives in different ways. And in that experience, it was a very literal thing, but also I was struggling inside with this world that I felt I couldn't bear, the world without my mother. And I think that you know, there's something about testing ourselves in that physical way that can really help us on the inside to try to figure those things out.
We have a minute left. Any advice that you have received along the way of your writing life that stuck with you and perhaps helped you through difficult writing times?
Well, I think it's just really important to remember it's hard for everyone. You know, so many people talk to me as if I just sort of sit at my desk and, you know, the dolphins are leaping in the water out the window with the rainbow in the distance, and it's just really easy for me to write. And it's not easy for me to write. And I've never really met a writer for whom it is easy. And so I think that when you feel alone and it's hard, and, you know, just remember that it just is hard, you know, and then we need to get past that sort of internal whiner who's always saying, and just do it. And I think that's how you get the work done, is just forging past those negative feelings. And that's been a great reminder for me over and over and over again. I have to remind myself every time I sit down to write.
Great advice, and loved having you here for the hour. I thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you. That just flew right by. I could talk to you for another hour.
That would be great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. That was Cheryl Strayed. Her books are Wild, Tiny Beautiful Things, and Torch. I have to read Torch now. And we're at the end of our time. I'm going to leave you with a quote that is the beginning of part five in Wild. It's a quote by the poet Mary Oliver from, actually, I think it's called The Summer Day. The poem is called The Summer Day, and the line is, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" It's a great quote, isn't it? I have to leave you now. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9. KUCI-FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll be with you next week if you want to know more about the show or Pen on Fire speaker series events. Please visit my website, my new revamped website, penonfire.com. Click on, it's either speaker series or writer salon, and you'll find out about our October 23rd event. In any case, have a great week, and I'll talk to you real soon.